So we all hear about AI constantly. It's just everywhere now, promising to revolutionize everything from, drug discovery to logistics. But what we often forget is that the engine of this revolution isn't really the software, it's the hardware.
Exactly. The high-performance semiconductor chips, the GPUs.
And right now, these tiny, miraculous pieces of silicon are at the absolute epicenter of a huge global technological conflict.
It's way beyond a simple trade dispute at this point. This is more like a quiet war, and it's being fought through supply chains, through export controls, and through some really strategic technical evasion.
So for today's deep dive, we've pulled together a really fascinating source stack. We have complex network analysis mapping out global trade flows, some game theory modeling looking at strategic conflict.
And crucially, some real-world case studies on how firms are actually evading these controls, from China all the way to Europe.
Our mission here is to give you a shortcut to really understanding this. We want to peel back the layers on how these global supply chains are being weaponized.
Right, and to figure out what the true choke points are. A little spoiler for you. It's not always the physical assets you'd think. And finally, we want to see how targeted countries are adapting to maintain their technological momentum.
Okay, let's unpack this.
So to really get the U.S. strategy here, you have to start with this foundational theory. It's called weaponized interdependence.
Sounds a bit academic.
It does, but the idea is actually very straightforward. It just means that because dominant states sit at the center of global networks, they can leverage that position to exert, well, massive influence over other countries.
So it's about using the network's own architecture against its users. If you control the hub, you control all the spokes.
That's it, exactly. And researchers like Farrell and Newman, they talk about two main mechanisms for this. First is what they call the panopticon effect.
Surveillance.
Basically, yeah, it's network surveillance. If all the important traffic flows through your node, you get to see everything. You gather strategically valuable information. Who's buying what? Where it's all going.
And the second mechanism is, I'm guessing, a lot more aggressive.
Much more. That's the choke point effect. This is the power to just deny network access to your adversaries. If you are that critical junction box, you can decide who gets to play and who gets shut off completely.
So it's information plus an off switch.
A very powerful off switch. And this is why the semiconductor chip is the perfect target for this strategy.
But why is that? I mean, they're physical goods.
Yeah.
Why can the US exert so much control even when the chips are made somewhere else, like Taiwan?
Because the chip is this ultimate hybrid asset. The final product, sure, it's silicon and metal, but its production relies critically on intangible assets. And that is where the U.S. really dominates. We're talking about intellectual property, the core IP, the circuit designs, and maybe most importantly, the electronic design automation tools, the EDA software.
So even if a company like TSMC in Taiwan is actually fabricating the chip, they're still using US design IP and US made software to create the blueprint for it. The US controls the blueprint.
That is the leverage point, precisely. And it lets the U.S. project that choke point effect globally. And, the stated goal here, which you hear from figures like National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan, is that leadership in these technologies is a national security imperative. It's not just business.
Okay, so if the US controls the intangible assets, the blueprints, how does that actually translate into stopping a physical container ship full of chips?
It translates through very targeted regulations. For countries like Russia or Belarus, for example, the rules are built on a presumption of denial.
Meaning you're not getting a license.
It's highly, highly unlikely. The controls target specific chips and manufacturing equipment, and the default answer is just no.
That sounds pretty final, but when we look at the deep dive into the global trade network, it shows the system isn't uniformly fragile, right? So where's the actual weak spot?
This is a really critical insight from the network analysis. The supply chain is sort of divided into three tiers. The downstream segment, so finished computers, components, that part is actually the most
Why
robust.
is that?
It just has the largest network, the highest trade density. It's diversified. So if one route gets shut down, the system can pretty easily adapt and find another.
Okay, so going after consumer electronics isn't the real choke point. The weak link must be somewhere else.
It's the upstream segment. We're talking wafers, and especially the manufacturing equipment itself. That tier has the smallest network, the lowest trade density. The research calls it the most alienated and weakest link.
So if you really want to choke the system, you don't go after the thousands of different finished products, you go after the handful of specialized machines that make them all.
Exactly. And the data also shows who the primary traffic cop is. The U.S. ranks first in something called betweenness centrality.
Meaning.
It means that if you trace a chip's journey, From raw material all the way to a finished product, the U.S. is almost always a mandatory waypoint or the regulator of that traffic. They hold the strongest control.
Okay, so the theory holds up. The U.S. is the dominant node. But the data also shows a huge insight into how sanctions are evaded, especially when we look at Russia's imports.
Oh, absolutely. The data shows this primary failure of the initial sanctions design. What happened was the growth in imports to Russia from countries without export controls, like China, Vietnam, Malaysia, It was an order of magnitude greater than from countries with controls.
Wait, hold on. So the sanctions didn't actually stop the chips from getting there. They just changed who Russia bought them from.
Precisely. They rerouted the supply chain almost overnight. We're talking a 160% growth rate for processors from those non-EC countries. The target just shifts its procurement to friendlier channels.
That seems like a pretty effective workaround, but there's this big catch hanging over those Asian suppliers, right? The U.S. Foreign Direct Product Rule, the FDP.
The FDP rule is the key. It's what gives the U.S. control beyond its own borders. It basically says that if a Taiwanese factory uses even one piece of American tech software equipment, anything in its production line.
Then the U.S. claims the right to veto where that final chip goes.
You got it. It turns a domestic U.S. rule into a global mandate. And that puts all those new friendly supply channels under direct threat.
So if simply rerouting your supply chain is now at risk, you have to get a lot more creative. You can't just change the shipper. You have to. You have to change the tech itself.
This brings us to the technical battlefield.
Yeah.
And this is where it gets really interesting.
Right. If you can't get the absolute best chips, you have to find a way to maximize the performance of the compliant ones you can get. Which leads us to this fascinating case study of Tencent.
This is a great example. So Tencent trained its big language model, Hunyuan Large, using an export-compliant NVIDIA GPU, the H20.
And the H20 is specifically designed to be less powerful, to fall under those U.S. export thresholds. It's been nerfed, so to speak.
It has. Lower raw compute performance than the flagship H100 chip. But, and this is the key, they found a really counterintuitive advantage in its design.
The VRAM advantage.
The VRAM. The H20 comes standard with 96 gigabytes of it. The top tier H100, on the other hand, usually comes in an 80 gigabyte configuration.
And for training these massive language models, the memory capacity, the VRAM, that's often the real bottleneck, sometimes even more than raw speed.
It often is. It's astonishing, really. Because the U.S. restrictions forced a redesign for a compliant chip, they seem to have inadvertently given the Chinese market an edge in high memory chips. And those are critical for loading these absolutely gargantuan models.
So you can fit a larger model into memory and train it more efficiently, even if the number crunching itself is a little bit slower.
It's a strategic trade-off. They're prioritizing model size over raw computational speed.
That's just brilliant hardware optimization, but that's only half the story. If you can't get more physical speed, you have to be doing some dramatic things on the software side.
Oh, absolutely. They are squeezing every last drop of performance out of that hardware with software. First, you see heavy use of what's called mixtures of experts, or MoE.
MoE, right.
Right.
That lets you train much bigger models without needing a huge jump in compute power, correct?
Yeah, it's like having a team of specialized submodels working together instead of one giant, inefficient, monolithic one. It's a much more efficient architecture.
And what about just making the training process faster on the slower hardware?
For that, they lean heavily on things like mixed precision training, specifically using a 16-bit data type called BFloat16 instead of the full 32-bit. That cuts memory usage and can speed up training by up to 2.5 times.
And if they still run out of VRAM on a single GPU for these truly giant models?
That's where sharding comes in. Using frameworks like DeepSpeed, they can partition everything, the model parameters, the gradients, the optimizer states, across a whole network of GPUs, CPUs, and even just regular system RAM.
So they're virtually creating one massive pool of memory out of many different machines.
Exactly. They're basically solving a hardware problem with a software solution. It's a direct counter to the U.S. strategy.
It's strategic adaptation at its finest. But this isn't just happening in China. We saw a really important example of this kind of corporate de-risking from a German firm, SUSE Microtech.
Right, and SUSE Microtech is a crucial player upstream. They make specialized equipment for semiconductor manufacturing. When the German government started screening exports to China more strictly, they ran into huge delays.
And the company's response just perfectly illustrates how corporations see this risk. They viewed their dependence on U.S. components as a ticking time bomb.
They absolutely did. They took two big steps. First, They dramatically expanded their factory in Taiwan. That simple rerouting to get around German export licensing.
But the second step is the one that really gets at the long-term strategic problem for the U.S.
It is. The firm publicly acknowledged that relying on U.S. components put them at risk. So they announced they are actively qualifying alternative suppliers for their previous U.S. suppliers.
They're intentionally trying to design U.S. tech out of their supply chain.
Yes, it's a costly, strategic push to protect their access to the Asian market. They're following a letter of the law. They aren't breaking German rules. But they are completely circumventing the spirit of it by accelerating their own decoupling.
Which brings us to the bigger picture. All these moves and countermoves, they're feeding into a loop that game theory can help us understand.
Right. And the modeling here shows that this continuous escalation of export controls by the U.S., it eventually leads to diminishing returns.
The more you squeeze, the less effective that squeeze becomes, and you're just pushing your target toward becoming self-sufficient even faster.
Exactly. There's this nested game happening. The U.S. is the leader in the international game. It sets the sanctions. China is the follower. It responds. But internally, China then becomes the leader of its own domestic game, using massive state support, like that $143 billion package, to force its own companies like SESIC and Huawei toward total independence.
So it's an internal race to build whatever they can no longer buy. And what's the predicted outcome of this escalating back and forth?
The consensus seems to be that we're heading for a tipping point, a moment where the global technology landscape just bifurcates. It splits into two distinct competing technological regimes, one led by the U.S., one led by China.
And the cost of that split isn't just geopolitical, it hits global efficiency, global innovation.
It does. The simulations showed something pretty worrying. Both sides tend to favor aggressive strategies almost regardless of the situation, and that risks locking everyone into what they call a suboptimal equilibrium.
Which means?
It means reduced collaboration, inefficient knowledge sharing, and critically, this massive, wasteful duplication of R&D efforts across two competing tech ecosystems.
So we all end up paying twice for the same basic innovations, which could slow down the overall pace of progress for everyone.
Right. And, you know, we started this deep dive talking about AI as the technology driving this conflict.
And the irony is AI is also supposed to be the key to managing the fallout. A lot of the sources emphasize that AI is crucial for supply chain resilience, for spotting risks, for rerouting logistics in real time when there's a disruption.
And that's the final provocative thought we want to leave you with. If this technological bifurcation continues, if we really do end up with two separate, less interoperable tech ecosystems, how much harder does it become for global companies to build the resilient AI-enabled supply chains they so urgently need? The very tool you need to manage the disruption is itself being threatened by the fragmentation this conflict is creating.